The headlines this hour. U.S. government report on the origins of COVID-19 concludes that the virus may have been leaked from a Chinese lab in Wuhan. Iran says that it's time for the U.S. to change course and to stop using economic terrorism as bargaining leverage against Tehran. And Peru's presidential candidate Keiko Fujimori alleges fraud in the Sunday runoff election as her rival takes a narrow lead in the vote count. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. government study on the origins of COVID-19 reportedly finds that the hypothesis of a virus leak from a Chinese laboratory in Wuhan is plausible. The classified study by a U.S. nationalist laboratory called for further investigation into the issue. According to the Wall Street Journal, the secret survey was carried out in May 2020 as part of a State Department inquiry into the origins of the pandemic. President Joe Biden said last month he had ordered aid to find answers to the origin of the virus. U.S. officials have accused China of withholding data on the issue. Beijing has denied that. In March, a World Health Organization team concluded that the lab origin of the virus is extremely unlikely. Commentator Fabrizio Goldoni says the U.S. is trying to score political points by raising questions about the origin of the coronavirus pandemic.
Because it can be propaganda, can be some political interest behind this kind of news, and we have to look 360 degrees, you know, not only in China, but also outside. The origin, basically, the possibility is only two. Or is it natural, or is it a laboratory accident. If it's a laboratory accident, you know, has to be found some evidence. If it's an animal, we have to find the host. We have, papers from the Barcelona University that bring the case in Spain at 12th of March of 2019. Mm-hmm. We have papers in Italy from a very important institute, if you want, I can quote, the National Cancer Institute, where they detect virus in the blood samples, and they bring back the infection in September 2019, when the first official case in Italy was 21st of February of 2020. So there is quite a lot of things that has to be investigated, in my opinion.
Iran's foreign minister says that his country still does not know if the current U.S. administration is ready to change its predecessor's policies regarding the Iran nuclear deal. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said that the U.S. needs to bury the failed maximum pressure policy of the former administration. He said that it's time for Washington to change course and to stop using economic terrorism as bargaining leverage against Tehran. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that his country is unsure whether Iran is ready to resume compliance with the nuclear accord. Tehran says its gradual scale-back of its commitments is in accordance with the terms of the 2015 deal. The U.S. withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Political commentator Frank M. Speck says the lack of leadership on the part of the U.S. President Joe Biden is the main issue, hampering progress in the JCPOA revival talks.
And certainly if one side violates the treaty, the other side can pull out. Well, the United States violated the treaty, it pulled out. And so the Iranians went to the Europeans and said, look, we still want to play ball here. Help us out. We don't want you to agree to the sanctions. And the Europeans made some steps, but never put into real play the other trade agreements that they said they would do. So, you know, from the Iranians' position, they're saying, who are these people? That makes perfect sense. But this isn't a question of trust. This is a question of, is the United States going to do this or not? And there are certain clear indicators one way or the other. One of them is going to be financial transactions. Another might be not sinking Iranian ships, whoever did that. Another one might be to allow the oil to begin to circulate more. These are things that could be done as confidence-building schemes. And I think that's what everybody is waiting for. And I believe everybody has said that. Both sides have said that. They know, everybody knows, once specific things can be done to build confidence. This isn't a question of trust. It's a question of doing something. And I think the world, not only Iran, but people here, want to move here. I think there is a feeling that we should have some kind of normal relations with Iran. But unless that happens, unless there's some leadership, and the leadership is probably what the Iranian government is looking at here, or the lack thereof, and we don't see that.
Iranians are preparing to cast their ballots in the upcoming presidential election as candidates are doing their best to woo voters. Officials and supporters of candidates are also seeking to encourage more people to go to the polls on election day.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Election Special. Thank you for joining us. With less than 2 weeks before Iran's presidential election, the country's election commission has called for a mass voter turnout. The commission's spokesman, Ismail Mousavi, said over 59 million people are eligible to vote in the June the 18th election. He said there will be more than 72,000 polling stations across the country, up by more than 10,000 compared to the previous elections in order to alleviate concerns about the coronavirus pandemic. Mousavi also emphasized that all candidates are required to comply with the health regulations in their electoral campaigns, warning that any violations of the protocols will be met with punitive measures. Well, the candidates approved to run for the top executive post are talking about their plans to resolve the country's problems. The first candidate we are going to talk about is Ebrahim Raisi. He is running for president on a platform of tackling economic problems such as poverty, unemployment, and inflation. In a campaign rally on Monday, he once again reiterated his promise to put an end to corruption. Here's more.
In the past 2 years, as the head of Iran's judiciary, I've seen many court cases that show people's concern about corruption and discrimination. My administration will have no red line in fighting corruption. The root cause of injustices in the executive branch of the government must be dried up. The banking, tax, import, and export systems must be reformed. And if the government's monitoring of goods, currency, and communications increases, we will not see a corruption case in the country every single day. God willing, with your help, we will resolve the problems. I think it is quite possible to change the current situation.
Another presidential candidate is Mohsen Rezaei. He says his potential administration will be one of action and breakthrough. Rezaei says the governance system in the Iranian economy needs to change. In his latest interview, he has outlined his plan to boost domestic production.
We'll improve the conditions necessary for businesses. This means that we lower business costs. For example, sometimes when a producer wants to take out a loan, they have to wait for 6 months. This results in an increase in expenses for that business. But my administration will increase profitability in the production sector by decreasing such business costs. We'll also levy taxes on non-productive sectors and cut taxes on production sector. We'll also use new technologies like fintech, blockchain, and cryptocurrencies.
Alireza Zakani says different sectors in the country have the capacity to create 1 million or millions of jobs for the people. The principalist lawmaker says his administration can create over 2 million jobs in the next 2 years. Let's take a listen to what he has to say.
I believe Iran has many capacities, so if we manage to activate these capacities, we will even be needing labor forces from abroad. We can make a minimum of 500,000 jobs in the first 6 months, and then 1.5 million jobs the next year, and then 2 million jobs a year afterward. We now have 2.5 million people awaiting employment. In addition to that, there are 3.5 million seasonal and constructional workers and female household heads. Hopefully, with the help of God, these problems will not exist in the future.
Iranian presidential candidate Saeed Jalili says he has plans to bring inflation in Iran under control. The former top nuclear negotiator also says he has plans to bring economic benefits to low-income families. The 55-year-old candidate pledged an elaborate health care plan for everyone in the country if he is elected president.
Regarding inflation, I have to say that the whole production cycle, I mean from production to consumption, has to be under the supervision of the government, and people can play a leading role here. If this production cycle is designed through using smart technologies and electronic government, many of our economic problems will be resolved. We have three major plans to get the lower deciles of the society out of the current economic crisis. We also have a comprehensive healthcare plan for all Iranian citizens in a way that people can make the most of their healthcare benefits with the least difficulty.
Mohsen Mehralizadeh says he believes an socio-economic approach as a remedy to Iran's ailing economy. He says his government will be able to provide much-needed services to the people of the country if elected president. The 64-year-old candidate says if economic policies are pursued in the way they should be, Iran can compete with the world's economic powers. Here's more.
Scandinavian countries came up with the idea of a social market economy in the 1930s. The socio-economic approach calls for the eradication of special economic rents and privileges for certain people. It also provides free and fair healthcare services, pensions, entertainment for all ages, and all sorts of services to the people of a country. We have all sorts of potentialities to become an economic power, like some countries in Europe. That includes young people, good education, decent facilities, natural resources, interaction with the world, and so on and so forth.
The candidates are scheduled to appear in two more live televised debates to outline their plans for the next 4 years. The second debate is going to be aired on Tuesday, June the 8th, and the last one will be aired next Saturday on June the 12th. The seven candidates will be given equal time to discuss their plans and answer the questions asked by the moderator in three-hour forms. Well, that's a wrap for now. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome back. Peru's presidential candidate Keiko Fujimori has alleged fraud in Sunday's runoff election as her rival Pedro Castillo took a lead in the vote count. Right-wing Fujimori says that she has evidence of what she calls a clear intention to boycott the popular will in the election. Fujimori had led early counting, but far-left trade unionist Castillo gained ground as votes from Peru's rural areas came in. Nearly 95% of ballots have been counted so far. Castillo has gotten 50.2%, Fujimori 49.7%. Castillo has urged election authorities to protect the vote and told supporters that he will respect the will of the people. Peru is currently struggling with an economic recession and the highest per capita COVID death rate globally. Canadian police say that a car ramming attack on Sunday that killed four members of a Muslim family in London, Ontario, was a hate crime.
We believe that this was an intentional act and that the victims of this horrific incident were targeted. We believe the victims were targeted because of their Islamic faith.
Police have charged a 20-year-old man with four counts of first-degree murder. An elderly woman died on the spot while a man, another woman, and a teenage girl died after being taken to the hospital. A 9-year-old boy was also hospitalized and is now recovering. The family was walking across the sidewalk when a pickup truck ran them over at an intersection. The National Council of Canadian Muslims has denounced the attack as an act of terror. Canadian law enforcement authorities are trying to also bring terrorism charges against the suspect. Muslim rights activist Firas Al-Najim says Muslims are discriminated upon systematically in Canada.
This is actually something outrageous that we're seeing now, a trend of actually. These kind of attacks are happening against Muslims, and also it's a systematic attacks that are happening as well. The Muslims are discriminated upon systematically here in Canada. So we see a lot of different cases that have to do with Muslims that are, there's no justice really served for them. And in this case, you know, it's nobody jumps on to call it a terrorist attack. They're sitting using other words, you know, some words are strong, but they're not strong enough as what they usually label Muslims, for instance, right? Like whenever, if a person is, say, an extremist Muslim, let's say, and he's deviated and he does some kind of attack right ahead, they jump on it, the media, and basically media, he's an Islamist, terrorist, this and that. And people are used to that now in the system, that people always have to hear Islamist, terrorist. So it's hard for them to say when it's a white person or if it's a Zionist. For instance, a person that has indoctrinated with some kind of, you know, extremist views. So we see that there's a biased system, and this has to be changed. And social media has become a very strong tool for a lot of people. And there's now a lot of Muslim organizations that are actually raising their heads, and they're raising their voices, and they're speaking, such as NCCM and other organizations. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, this is good. It's making a change. It's putting some pressure on the government that we want equality.
The death toll from the Monday train collision in southern Pakistan has risen to 63, as rescuers clear much of the wreckage. Pakistani authorities say that the victims range from a month-old infant to a woman who was 81 years old. Over 100 people were also injured. The incident occurred in Sindh province before dawn on Monday. A high-speed passenger train collided with another one that had derailed minutes earlier. The derailed train was en route from Karachi to Lahore. Train accidents are common in Pakistan due to a poorly maintained signal system and aging tracks. Officials say the latest incident was the worst since the year 2005. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Listeners, we're with you with another episode of this series. Continuing with discussion of Imam Khomeini's ethical virtues, you will hear more on his high carefulness about achieving spirituality and expurgation of the soul. Please stay with us. According to Islamic culture, the remembrance of death is one of the means to gain spirituality and to purify your soul. Remembrance of death revives the heart and reminds the individual that the world is transient. Hence, he should make the best use of the time on this world for self-building. In Islamic narrations, we read, "Increase the remembrance of death, because no servant of God has increased the remembrance of death except God has revived his heart and made death easy for him." The 10th infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace be upon him, says, "Remember the time when you are lying in deathbed in your family. While no physician can prevent your death, nor any friend can benefit you." One of the recommendations of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, for young students of seminaries was to remember death. He used to tell the students to think that every moment of man's life is a step towards death and grave. Hujjatul Islam Hamid Rouhani says, Imam Khomeini said in his first speech after arriving in Najaf in Iraq, "Think right from now. Think right from your youth. Every step that you take is towards grave. Every minute that passes in your life, you're getting a little closer to the grave and the place in which you'll be interrogated. What matters is approaching death, and no one has given you a document that you will live for 120 years. Man may die at the age of 25. God forbid he may die just right now. There is no document. You should take heed and expurgate your soul." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to emphasize on purification of the soul or expurgation of the soul and the self, just as the individual acquires knowledge or even more than that. According to Quranic teachings, he believed that the prerequisite for real benefiting of knowledge is to engage in self-expurgation. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Reza Tawassuli recounts an anecdote in this regard. He says, Imam Khomeini used to advise young students at classes, saying, "Expurgate yourselves. Moral expurgation is before acquisition of knowledge, and if man wants to benefit from his knowledge, he should first be expurgated." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini would advise young students to take 2 steps in self-expurgation for every step in acquiring knowledge. Ayatollah Hassan Ghadiri says, "The Imam not only himself was expurgated, but also he always tried to train students with expurgation. And he used to advise them from time to time, and that through his special method of sincerity and love. Years later, we still recall his advice. He used to say that for every step in knowledge, 2 steps should be taken in expurgation of the soul. He said, "All leaders of false religions have been scholars, but they have not expurgated their souls." Dear friends, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to tell young students to appreciate their youth for worship and attaining good virtues, so that they get accustomed to those virtues. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Amid Zanjani related an account. One day, the Imam told the students, "Try not to let evil characteristics take root in you, because with the passage of time, these characteristics will be firm, and the person will reach the place that it would be impossible to get rid of these characteristics or bad habits. As long as you are young, try to get accustomed to worship." Ayatollah Sayyid Ja'far Karimi also has an anecdote with regards to Imam Khomeini. He says, Imam Khomeini perhaps would remind scores of times, "Do everything such as writing, studying, research, worship, attaining spiritual virtues in your youth, and make use of the circumstances." Although Imam Khomeini emphasized on worship for young students, he would warn against going to extremes. Martyr Ayatollah Fazlullah Mahallati says, Imam Khomeini would tell students, if the youth stick to recommended deeds, they would be distanced from obligatory deeds. He would even say, those who were too scared left the seminary due to such extremes. Too much worship is tiring for teenagers, of people of 15 or 16 years of age. Youth should enjoy legitimate entertainment, but shouldn't sin. He even said, they can wrestle, but not backbite. Ayatollah Ahmad Jannati says, once I asked Imam Khomeini to guide me on spiritual perfection. He said, strive in purity of action. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Mu'min also said, when I was in Najaf, I wrote a letter to the Imam and requested him to advise me, even if it is a general advice. He said, the best advice is the one that God has given in the Holy Quran. Say, I give you just a single advice, that you rise up for Allah's sake. The Imam considered remembrance of God as an important factor for inward building and attaining and preserving of light in the heart and the soul. Later Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Badala also says with regards to Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, I remember once the Imam said during his ethical classes in Qom, those who take steps in the way of self-building, sometimes there will be small holes of light for them. The more this hole is preserved, the more it will increase. After the class, I asked the Imam how to preserve this luminous state. He answered, that state should be kept through communication with God and remembrance of God, and man should be in remembrance of God as much as he can.
The debate.
The discovery of remains of 215 children, some as young as three, at a former residential school in Canada, has reopened wounds among the indigenous survivors of colonial Canadian schools. Yet, when it comes to condemning Canada, condemnations were very far and in between. In this edition of the debate, we will look at the depth of this problem in Canada and why the indigenous community and First Nation people continue to be discriminated and traumatized even to this day.
The last month discovery of the remains of 215 children at a former Catholic school for Indigenous students in Canada has reopened old wounds and fueled outrage in the country about the lack of information and accountability regarding violations of Indigenous people's rights. On the weekend, thousands of Canadians took to the streets in Toronto to call for greater action from the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the country's infamous residential school system.
What they need to do is acknowledge that this was a wrong. What Trudeau doesn't want to acknowledge that it was a genocide. But there's actually been five genocides, the fifth one ongoing.
Demonstrators also tore down the statue of Egerton Ryerson, one of the architects of the residential school system at a Toronto university named after him. Following the discovery of the mass grave at a site of Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia, Trudeau said it was a painful reminder of a shameful chapter in Canada's history and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility for its role in such schools. Pope Francis expressed his pain over the discovery, but stopped short of offering a direct apology.
Seguo con dolore
I follow with pain the news coming from Canada about the shocking discovery of the remains of 215 children, pupils of the Camp Loops Indian Residential School in the province of British Columbia. I join the Canadian bishops and the entire Catholic Church in Canada in expressing my closeness to the Canadian people traumatized by the shocking news. The sad discovery further raises awareness of the pains and sufferings of the past.
Indigenous leaders and school survivors, however, dismissed the Pope's expression of pain, saying the Church needs to do much more. Between the 1870s and 1990s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend boarding schools which were run by churches and aimed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children into the white Canadian society. The children were separated from their families and barred from speaking Indigenous languages while experienced physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, among other forms of mistreatment. More than 4,000 Indigenous children are known to have died at Canada's residential schools, but efforts continue to find others who never returned home. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that a country committed, quote, cultural genocide with its decades-long residential school system. Besides, reports suggest thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. Canada has touted itself as the first country in the world to adopt a multiculturalism policy. It has also depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. Nonetheless, the discovery of the bodies at a former boarding school and lack of meaningful action on the issue of missing women and girls have raised serious questions about such claims.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, and joins us from Ontario. We also have lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Edward Corrigan, let me first start with you. I mean, we did cover what happened in this tragic incident, but why don't you give us a quick wrap-up as to what actually occurred?
Well, there was a deliberate policy to assimilate the natives' children. They felt that the adult indigenous people were not couldn't be changed, but if they take the children, and the quote was to kill the Indian in the child. So children were ordered and taken from their families and forced to go to these schools. As many as 150,000 children were there, 138 schools. And, you know, the conditions were horrific. They were, they were cold, they were not proper ventilation. They would put children who were sick with tuberculosis in with the other children. So that at one school, I read that 69% of the children died. And they estimate that around 25% of the children who attended the schools did die, but they don't have proper record keeping. The 215 children's bodies that were found in Kamloops is just the tip of the iceberg. There's other schools where they found 15 bodies, and I think if they were to examine, the other schools, 138 schools, they would also find bodies there. They're buried in unmarked graves. They're not properly looked after. The families, in many cases, were not notified of the death of their children. It was just silence. And this is, government policy, government funding, run by the churches, and they were trying to, force them to convert to Christianity. They punished them if they spoke the native language. They didn't even speak English or French. And it really was like a penal colony. And you have, horrific treatment. And, of course, it didn't work. The native children didn't have the skills to compete, yet they were also torn away from their own societies and cultures and couldn't even maybe communicate with their parents because they knew English or French, but the parents did not. They only spoke Indigenous language. So it is horrific that how these natives were treated. And it was based upon sort of the aggressive assimilation policy that was employed in the United States by General Ulysses Grant. But yeah, this is a really dark, terrible history, chapter in Canada's history.
It really is, and I'm looking down at some of the things that confirms some of the statements that you made there. And Jonathan Levy, I'd like to find out from you, why were they targeted in such a form and manner? Why, for example, would the church or the residential school system forcibly separate these First Nation children from their families? But in essence, why were they being targeted?
Well, as Mr. Corrigan pointed out, there was a
genocidal policy behind it. But in addition, there was already a policy in Canada of contracting with the Catholic Church to provide social services, and the provinces made money. They were paid money by the federal government. In the case of Quebec, 100,000 children went through orphanages and institutions. Some were First Nations people, and some were just simply from disadvantaged families. And the Catholic Church used them for medical experimentation, administered electroshock because they would be paid more money if the children were labeled psychiatric cases. And this went on for 20, 30 years in Quebec. And we're still trying to locate, you know, the mass graves from there. We know where some of them are. The group is called the Duplessis Orphans, and that's a subset of the larger problem in Canada and the terrible problem with the Catholic Church providing social services and everybody making money from it. It was not just genocide, but a corrupt financial bargain between some of the provincial governments and the Catholic Church.
Okay. Again, I'm trying to get to the origins of how this all came about. So you have these First Nation children, and then you have the church, which is supposed to obviously spell religion, come and take them away from their parents and commit some of the most brutal acts that both of our guests here have talked about. Jonathan Levy, you mentioned it, and Edward Corrigan, you also. It doesn't quite make sense as to why a church would do that, why they would do experiments on these children to go to that extreme. And it comes back to my question as to why they were being targeted in this form and manner. Edward Corrigan, can you expand a little bit more for us on that?
Well, it's basically racism. And the English settlers and the French settlers that came here thought that their society was superior to the natives. And the churches fought the same, and they wanted to take the children away from their indigenous beliefs, which were considered pagan, and turn them into Christians. And this was done, you know, in horrific ways through punishment. If the parents didn't release the children, they weren't able to get baby bonuses. And during this period, actually, Indians had no right to vote. If they got, you know, professional skills, they were removed, taken away from, you know, Indian status. They were, these experiments on food. There's a whole pile of different experiments where they would keep a test group and keep them, you know, malnourished, then try to have another group of children that would have different, you know, higher and better food. But it was, you know, it said, you look at these, it looks like terrible prison conditions of the worst kind. And, you know, the children were all packed in together. And so if one child had tuberculosis or any other diseases, it would spread to all the other children. So, you know, very high numbers of diseases affected the kids. And of course, many children died because they had inadequate food, inadequate health care, inadequate ventilation. And everything about this was a disaster. And the more numbers they had, the more money they got. But there was not enough money to look after the children properly. And, you know, the federal government provided some money, the province, you know, the province has control over education, but not with regard to the Indians. They were considered wards of the federal government, but they never were properly looked after. So you have these, you know, horrific memories being dragged back because of the discovery of the 215 graves. But there's, you know, probably, you know, 6,000 or more graves like this, and many people, they don't know who is buried there. And there's this, you know, these children just sort of disappeared. People ran away from the schools because they're so horrific, and they were punished severely if that happened. But the families weren't told, in many cases, you know, if their child died, and they were sent away from populated areas to try to minimize the contact between the families and the children, and this sort of aggressive assimilation project to turn, you know, the natives into, you know, good little, you know, English-speaking citizens or French-speaking citizens. And, you know, they were, you know, up until, as you know, 1996 was the last school that closed, which is not that long ago. So this period, And, you know, there were periodic reports, and the Truth and Reconciliation report is very, very important. And it, you know, termed that what was treated, how the Indian children were treated and the natives were treated was cultural genocide. So I agree with that. But, you know, this is over, you know, barely 25 years ago, and there was no punishment. You know, they're unmarked graves, and they build over stuff. And, you know, it's when they were putting in a water line, and they uncovered 15 bodies at one school. So there are many, many schools, and people estimate that perhaps as many 25% of the children who attended these schools ended up dying, you know, primarily of disease. But there was sexual abuse, physical abuse, and, you know, social and psychological abuse was all part and parcel of this attempt to assimilate the Indians and natives of indigenous people.
Okay, so we have expanded on that as much as we can. So we have an idea about the horrific experiences that these kids had. But could the possibility, Jonathan Levy, be that this is all about land? We know that Canada asserted control over indigenous people and lands. It was just in 1985 when indigenous people were viewed as citizens. So this is very recent. And I'm just trying to connect the dots here. If it's related in any sense that they are taking the kids away because these lands would eventually be transferred to the kids. But without the kids, then you have the adults that they have to deal with, which at some point they're going to pass away. Of course, then you have restrictions, you have discrimination exercised against them. Is that an outlook or a way to look at this situation?
Sadly, in Canada, there's been a lot of institutional abuse, and finances have also been, you know, the motivation. So, yeah, if you're committing genocide against a people, the idea is you are going to try to diminish them and perhaps take their land, which has always been a problem with the First Nations people. And of course, the entire institutional system with orphans in Canada was based on making money from the federal government. So there was a very strong profit motive involved. And, you know, the people involved should be punished both financially and morally for what they've done. Because, again, some of it was indeed trying to perhaps change the Indians into something they were not. But really, when you look at it, it was genocide. And the idea of genocide is to extinguish people.
Well, what about the Canadian government here, Edward Corrigan? I'm looking at the figure over here that the government had, committed to back in 2019. We can go and check that stat out. $28.1 million was just allocated. It was $33.8 million was allocated for this. But out of that figure, $27.1 million has yet to be spent. Why is the Canadian president, who in his speeches does talk about the indigenous people and how they're being victimized, but not doing really much about it, as he's been criticized for?
Well, there was a $1.9 billion compensation fund that was set up by the federal government to compensate, you know, Indian Native children who were in the residential school system. They got $10,000 for if they were there for a year or part of the year, and then $3,000 for each additional year. But they had to sign a release that there would not be any other claim of compensation against the government or the churches. They did have some exemptions for, you know, sexual abuse and severe physical abuse, but this was a way of trying to, you know, hide the real extent of the problem and give, you know, what is probably fairly limited compensation for the treatment that these, you know, children received. Now, the Catholic Church has not formally apologized for its treatment. The Anglican Church, the United Church, and the Presbyterian Church have, in fact, apologized. But the Catholic Church, you know, was the largest provider of these schools, you know, in Quebec, across Canada. There's, you know, set over 138 of these schools. And you have, it was sort of a sick system. People were sick. They were put to school, even if they were dying. And of course, if they have a disease that's contagious, it immediately gets spread to the other students that are in these, you know, close confined quarters. And it's, you know, it is really sad when you're reading about these reports. It just, you can't believe how bad it was. And there were some people who did try to solve the problem. And there was some talk of even getting rid of the reserve system. The reserve system in Canada actually is kind of like a system of apartheid, where the Indians keep on land. And the South African government at one point came up to study the reserve system in Canada to use it as a model for their own system of apartheid in South Africa. And I think that's a shocking revelation. If you think most Canadians would not say, oh, we never had apartheid, we're good, you know, we treat people properly. But unfortunately, it's the opposite of the case. There was really brutal treatment of these children. And, you know, cultural genocide, you know, bordering on, you know, physical genocide. And the orphans were taken away from the children, or even if they had parents, and were put up for adoption. You know, there's 20-plus thousand people were put through the orphan system. And, you know, it's a really sad, sad chapter of Canada's history. Now, hopefully, the federal government will, you know, take responsibility and also put the money in so that they can identify who, in fact, is buried in these unmarked graves and provide some sort of compensation and closure for the families.
Well, right now, the Canadian Prime Minister is actually, Jonathan Levy, criticizing the Catholic Church. Aside from what our guest there, Edward Corrigan, says about closure, that responsibility being in the hands of the government. The church is supposed to come out, is supposed to take some responsibility here based on what the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said. And there's been a lot of critique leveled against the Pope that he has not come out with apology really on this. And for the for that institution to take responsibility, why do you think that is?
There's clearly duplicity involved here between both Trudeau and the Pope. The Canadian government can hold the Catholic Church through their various orders in Canada responsible if it had the will to do so. So what you're seeing here is the Canadian government can blame the church. The church doesn't apologize. The Canadian government says, well, we can't resolve this because the church isn't cooperating. The church knows where the graves are, where the grave sites are. And they're working behind the scenes, hand in glove, both of them trying to avoid greater liability. The Canadian government has done a settlement with some of the native peoples, but there is a similar problem with non-native peoples who were forced into orphanages run by the church for the profit motive. So that's why it's a duplicitous game between Trudeau and the Pope. The Pope is sort of, they're bouncing it off each other, neither one wanting to take responsibility. And indeed, the Catholic Church has escaped liability almost altogether in these matters. And they own vast tracts of land. They have the resources to make a settlement. And they're not accountable to anyone, even though Trudeau could hold them accountable if he wanted to.
Okay, in less than a minute, Edward Corrigan, discrimination against Indigenous people still happens. Is it being addressed properly, or is there a lack of this issue being addressed within Canada? Under a minute.
It's not being addressed properly because you still have, you know, much higher incarceration rates for the native population. And, you know, you have alcoholism, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, a whole pile of psychiatric disorders, which stem from actually the residential school system, plus, you know, racism against, you know, our Indigenous population. I think one of the reasons why the Catholic Church doesn't want to give a formal apology is that because of legal liability, if they're admitting that they're responsible, that would be a strong base upon which to launch lawsuits against the, you know, the Catholic Church and other churches. Okay. So the church is concerned about that. They want to limit their legal liability, but I think they should really take responsibility for this horrific period in the treatment of our Indigenous people.
Indeed. Thank you so much. We're going to end with the international human rights lawyer, Edward Corrigan. Thank you for your comments, and lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy there from London. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. So thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I've been Kavita Wei.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam,
the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أحبب حبيبك هونا ما عسى أن يكون بغيضك يوما ما وأبغض بغيضك هونا ما عسى أن يكون حبيبك يوما ما.
Imam Ali stated, "Have love for your friend up to a limit, for it is possible that he may turn into your enemy someday. And hate your enemy up to a limit, for it is possible that he may turn into your friend someday." Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We find a great many lessons from the universal persona of Imam Ali. One such lesson which we learn can be found on the day of Khaybar, when the Messenger of Allah was addressing Imam Ali. This sermon of the Holy Prophet has been reported by Khawarizmi, and he says that on that day, the Holy Prophet addressed Imam Ali and said, "Ya Ali, you will propagate my faith. You will fight the enemies of Islam after me. You are the nearest to me on the day of judgment. You are my vicegerent at the pond of Kawthar, which is the gathering place of the people, rejecting the hypocrites. And you, O Ali, are the first to meet me at Kawthar, and the first of my ummah to enter paradise. Your followers, on the day of judgment, will be quenched by the water of Kawthar. They will come to me with bright faces. I will intercede for them and will be my neighbors in paradise. Your enemies, on the day of judgment, will be restless out of thirst. Their faces will be darkened and wrinkled. Ya Ali, O Ali, enmity with you is enmity with me, and friendship with you is friendship with me." Dear friends, what a beautiful way, and in